A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 327. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are talking about Penda's Fen. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. Yes, this is a 1974 BBC production from their famous Play for Today series. It's a 90-minute film in colour, unlike, or at least it survives in colour, unlike the earlier Pay for Today we covered earlier this year. And it's an interesting combination for us. We've got a famous film director, we've got a very intriguing writer who we've encountered before, and we've got a lead actor who's famous from a very well-remembered children's science fiction show that we've covered on British Invaders. So there's, you know, interesting combination of people involved in this show, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. And this is October that we're releasing this, so we're going back to our idea of a Halloween horror film. And it's a challenging one with this folk horror-infused play, as we've done a number of these now. And in fact, there were a few Play for Today productions in the 1970s that did have this folk horror style and have this reputation of being sort of difficult and mysterious. So we will certainly get into that.
Yes, we will indeed, particularly as we our discussions continue.
Yes. So the setup, our main character, Stephen, is approaching his 18th birthday, and he is wrestling with a number of difficulties in life. He is being bullied at school and also in the cadet corps that he's part of. His religious beliefs are something that he is struggling with. And his developing sexuality is also a struggle for him. And his love of classical music and sort of classical stories is something that fits into this and ties some of these things together as well.
It does indeed. And of course, while Stephen is going through his troubled teens, around him, the normal life of England is portrayed and sort of unfolds on screen for us. So we see school, we see the church, we see sort of elements of the military with cadet cause. We see some of the politics of the time affecting Stephen and things that are going on around him in the village he lives in. And this is all happening while he's preparing for his 18th birthday, while his family are getting ready for this celebration. But while all these sort of almost normal everyday things are happening, there's some very unusual things happening to Stephen, in that he appears to be having a number of visions or insights or some sort of revelations to him, which are sort of shaking him to the core and making him question beliefs that he holds at the start of this film.
Yes, there are in fact a lot of questions in here. And that's part of what's interesting, is these sort of challenging and complicated questions that we're left to unravel.
Yes, interesting stuff. So let's talk about the characters. We've already mentioned Stephen, played with a sort of youthful intensity by Spencer Banks, who you'll probably best remember, like I do, as we do here on British Invaders, from the series Time Slip, where he was one of the two main protagonists involved in that slipping backwards and forwards in time show. One that we covered quite some time ago, Brian, but I remember we enjoyed it considerably.
We did, for sure. And this is Spencer Banks, who is a few years older. So we're now looking at a teenage actor rather than the younger actor we saw in Time Slip.
Yes, I think he was coming up for his 20th birthday when he made this. So it's okay, you know, he's playing this character coming up for his 18th birthday. And he, as we've said, he's sort of like, he's a character with some troubles and issues and a lot of quandaries. Things are changing for him.
Yes, very much so. And the struggles that he has internally and some of the strange things that are happening out in the world as well are sort of tied together, so we get some interesting things with that. Reverend Franklin, played by John Atkinson, is Stephen's father. He is the local vicar who we see writing sermons and this sort of thing, and also having involved metaphysical conversations with Stephen. And he sees that Stephen is struggling and refers to him as going through a phase. That is a phrase that might pique your interest. But yes, the relationship and the conversations between Stephen and his father are quite key to this.
Yes, and there are a few of them, some long conversations between Stephen and his father, the vicar. Meanwhile, his mother, Mrs. Franklin, played by Georgine Anderson, seems to be more pragmatic and just willing to accept Stephen and realise that he's having some difficulties, but to, you know, be more accepting about him. She gets less to do, unfortunately, because, as I say, some of Stephen's conversations with various other figures sort of predominate, but she's there as a sort of reassuring presence in the background, I guess.
Arne, played by Ian Hogg, who would go on to play Josiah in the Doctor Who story Ghostlight many years later. Arne is a radical television playwright and political activist, and we see Stephen attending talk/political rally almost that Arne is leading. And he becomes an influence for Stephen in his emerging political consciousness.
And I did wonder whether this was, you know, David Rudkin, the writer, putting himself somewhat into this show as this sort of TV playwright who has strong political views and tells us about them in this, or as you say, almost rally or polemic that he delivers.
Yes, that actually, that may be. That does make sense now that you mention it.
Then we've got a number of characters who Stephen is sort of in conflict with, although also at the same time, strangely sort of drawn to. There are some, you know, fellow schoolboys at his school. And there's also this character, Joel, played by Ron Smirzak. He is the local milkman. He is a sort of, you know, attractive and sort of very masculine figure, who provides this strange mixture of threat and attraction for Stephen. Stephen wants to befriend him, but at the same time, he gets a certain amount of verbal stick and bullying from Joel. And for some reason, you know, I will keep referring back to Robin Redbreast, a show that we covered earlier this year. He reminded me in some ways of the strange half-naked karate practitioner that we saw in that show, as another strange sort of almost folk horror infused portrayal of masculinity. So anyway, there he is. Joel is a strange character, a threat and a sort of draw for Stephen.
Yes, not as prominent as a character as the one you're talking about in Robin Redbreast, but perhaps used in a similar way. Sir Edward Elgar, the British composer, is played by Graham Leman, the composer whose music figures quite prominently in this. And we do see the composer at one point in a sort of vision. Stephen is able to have a conversation with Edward Elgar, and this becomes a significant part of things as well.
Yes, it's very interesting for the show because there are a couple of sort of historical figures who appear to Stephen in some sort of visions, and he can actually interact with them, as you say. So he gets to have a conversation with Sir Edward Elgar. I don't suppose we're going to be saying that very often here on British Invaders, but there it is. Elgar is portrayed in this show.
Yes, I can't think of another show we would cover that would have that. Occasionally we have had other shows that have music or a work of music as an important part of them. But actually having a real and well-known composer appear and be played by an actor, that is quite unusual for British sci-fi and related genre television.
Yes, interesting stuff.
So as we get into the story and ideas a little bit more, Stephen is talking about and sort of investigating Edward Elgar's work, The Dream of Gerontius, and it leads him to investigate the name of the place he lives, or something very near where he lives, which is Pinvin or Pinfin, and it has connections to the last pagan king of England, Penda, from the 7th century. So we get these ties to things from the distant past starting to come in with that.
Yes, and we begin to see where the title of this piece comes from. It's very much connected to where Stephen lives and also, as you say, to the distant past of England. And as you've said, Brian, he's a sort of thoughtful character. He thinks about a lot of stuff. He thinks about music, he thinks about religion, he thinks about politics. And some of his interest in the past is brought to sort of like the fore when he stops on his bicycle as he's out cycling home from school because a road worker is erecting a sign blocking off a road and referring to the village of Pinvin, but he spelt it wrong on this sign as you say, Pinfin, which sort of alludes to its origin as Penda's Fen. And as a result, he starts thinking about both Penda and seeing him in dreams and visions. But as we've said, there's also Elgar will crop up, his piece of music, which is used as a theme throughout the piece. And of course, around him, we get a little bit of insight into the rest of the world. We know that there's politics going on, that the times they are changing. It's a period, as ever, of change in England. So there's lots of stuff going on in this show. And there's this chap, Stephen, stuck in the middle of it, trying to wrestle with all this stuff as he approaches his 18th.
Yes, there are a lot of thematic things in here and a lot of ideas that have quite complicated connections to each other, and we've hinted at a number of things that are in here that we'll be able to get into in a bit more detail. But yeah, there's a lot there. But first, let's get into our production notes. The BBC Play for Today series ran from 1970 through 1984. With over 300 television films, many of them recognized as classics of British television. It was really an important thing, and the idea of plays as part of television was something that was very significant and very important.
Yes, I mean, it's a huge show in the history of the BBC and British television. We've only touched on it a few times on this show, but it does have a lasting impact.
For sure. In 1973, producer David Rose approached David Rudkin to write something for the series. And Rose had started his TV series as an assistant floor manager on 1984, back in 1954. This was the Nigel Neal and Rudolph Cartier production of 1984 that we've covered, but Rose would go on to found the Film on 4 brand on Channel 4. But at this point, he was working with Play for Today.
Yes, fascinating. As you say, Brian, he's probably best known for Film on 4, but for us, what a connection to have there. Yeah, you know, him starting his television career with Neal and Cartier's 1984, a show that we absolutely loved when we covered it, I remember.
Yes, it's a remarkable adaptation of George Orwell's novel.
And David Rudkin had also begun his sort of career with another adaptation of a remarkable novel, this time in cinema. He'd worked, I think, as a script editor on Truffaut's Fahrenheit 451 in 1966. For us here on British Invaders, he's best known for going on to write or to adapt M.R. James's The Ash Tree for a ghost story for Christmas in 1975. And he wrote the intriguing but possibly terminally confusing Artemis 81, which we've also talked about, Brian.
Yes, and I think as we go on in our next episode, we'll be able to talk about some of the things in common between Penda's Fan and Artemis 81, because there are some.
And then, of course, the other intriguing and fascinating figure in this production is Alan Clark, who is almost instantly recognizable for his very hard-hitting, gritty television plays, including the notorious Scum, about a sort of violent offenders unit for young adults. And that starred a very sort of young Ray Winston. And of course, the BBC wouldn't actually broadcast it in 1977. So Alan Clark went on to turn it into a feature film in 1979. But he also made later on a very sort of, again, another notorious show made in Britain, starring a very young Tim Roth. That was in 1982. He also produced a show about football hooligans called The Firm. So he, you know, he's known for these very hard-hitting, gritty shows. This is perhaps somewhat of an oddity in his career, doing Penda's Fen and taking the production to the actual village of Pinvin, which does exist. It's in Worcestershire, and that's where they did the filming. And again, we get these ties to this sort of history from the 7th century of King Penda, pre-Christian world for England.
That's nice that they were actually able to go to the actual location. It's rare that that's possible, so it's nice to see it there. Now, we've mentioned the importance of Elgar's music to this. A 1971 recording of Elgar's The Dream of Gerontius, conducted by Benjamin Britten, no less, with Yvonne Minton singing the part of the angel, was used throughout the production. And this particular recording is considered to be quite faithful to Elgar's original composition and the way that he wanted it to work.
And the second time this year we've mentioned Benjamin Britten on the podcast, Brian. I didn't think it would happen again, but here he is.
These major British composers are coming up, it seems.
Yes.
There was also original music composed by Paddy Kingsland from at the time with the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. He had worked on music for Doctor Who and The Changes and The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and many others. And in addition to original music for this, he did some electronic manipulation of some of the recordings of Elgar's music. So you hear little bits of electronically distorted versions, in addition to mostly hearing the recordings as is.
Yes, another fascinating name associated with his production, Paddy Kingsland, who's done some great electronic music over the years for these shows, Brian.
Oh, for sure. Penda's Fen was broadcast on BBC One on March 21st of 1974.
And we know from reviews from the time that it was instantly hailed as a sort of major work of television, although it was quite clear that some of the viewers and some of the critics didn't really understand what was going on. Many, of course, noted that it was a departure from Alan Clark's sort of usual television fare. And interestingly, of course, we get these little snippets, we get these little factoids, such as that Alan Clark himself wasn't entirely sure what was going on in the story. And I know from one of the sort of production notes that he actually asked David Rudkin which books he needed to read in order to understand what was going on in Penda's Fen. So there is some mystery about the meaning of the show, even for the director.
That's quite something. Yeah, it is not the most straightforward production, but has some interesting things in it.
And we know, as you say, originally broadcast 1974, we know it was repeated on the BBC in 1990 and sort of then, you know, built on its cult status by circulating copies, I guess, of off-air VHS recordings of the show in 1990. So it starts to build its reputation as one of the sort of, you know, great works from the 1970s and a bit of a cult hit.
And by 2006, Vertigo magazine was describing Penda's Fan as one of the great visionary works of English film. And in 2011, Penda's Fan was chosen by Time Out London magazine as one of the 100 best British films. So you get this idea of it being this remarkable work that is getting acclaim so many years later.
Yes, quite astonishing for a show that is somewhat hard to interpret to have such a reputation as, you know, being a great piece of British film. So if you want to watch this show yourself, we don't want you having to sort of look around for dodgy copies of off-air 1990 recordings, because in Region 2 from the BFI in 2016, we had both a DVD and a Blu-ray release featuring the film, a new high-definition remastering from the original negatives, it says on the back of my Blu-ray. It also features a short feature called The Landscape of Feelings, The Road to Penda's Fen, which was, it's about 16 minutes long. It features interviews with Rudkin and David Rose and many other collaborators with Alan Clark over the year. We should say that Alan Clark himself had passed away in 1990. Currently, that DVD set is £11.35 or £11.85 over here for the Blu-ray. I should say it also includes a booklet essay by the screenwriter Sukhdev Sandhu. Whether or not he explains or gives away plot twists is difficult to say with this show, Brian. I'm not sure I'm any clearer after reading the booklet, but there you go.
Yes, indeed. In Region 1, there is no release.
So this is an import again, I guess.
Yes, this one would definitely be an import. I think most of the Play for Today productions did not get a lot of international broadcast and so have not had much further international distribution.
And I don't think it's on the BFI's own streaming service, BFI Player. I don't fully understand BFI Player yet, but I can't find Penda's Fen there. I mean, if anybody does know what's going on with the BFI Player, perhaps they'd let me know on the Facebook group.
Yes, absolutely. It would be great to hear other things related to this. So next time, we will step into some of the ideas and more of the details about Penda's Fen and try to look at it as a piece of art, which I think is the best approach, and maybe compare it to the other Play for Today folk horror productions, and those actually are Robin Redbreast and Redshift. The three make a sort of television folk horror trilogy, which is a little bit interesting to talk about too.
Yes, and we may even mention Artemis 81 again, for a comparison with Rudkin's other works.
Absolutely.
Plus, we'll give you our review and recommendation of whether you should actually buy this DVD or Blu-ray yourself. So quite a bit to talk about next time, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. So until then, you can find us at BritishInvaders.com. All of our past episodes, including some other folk horror ones and the things we've mentioned, they're all available there. Or if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you can find our group there, and we'll have lots of interesting discussions, as always, hopefully talking about a bit of folk horror.
Yes, and you can also find us as members of the Voice of Geeks Network. Check out all that's going on there at vognetwork.com. Vognetwork.com, British Invaders is member of the Voice of Geeks.
So, thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yes, thank you very much indeed, and until next time, it's Eamon in England also, signing off.